Alrighty, now, as Nip mentioned, we have been talking about the Reinhard Gehlen organization and just who this individual is. Let me briefly sum up who Gehlen was and what his role in history is, and review very quickly a couple of the items that were on the first two Radio Free America broadcasts. First of all, General Reinhard Gehlen, last name spelled G-E-H-L-E-N, was Hitler's chief of intelligence for the Eastern Front during World War II, that is to say, the warfare against Soviet Russia during World War II. Now, Gehlen's organization, Hitler's Eastern Front Intelligence Organization, was known as Foreign Armies East, or Fremde Heere Ost, in the original German. Now, at the end of the Second World War, Reinhard Gehlen and his entire Eastern Front Intelligence Organization jumped to the Central Intelligence Agency and basically became the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. Gehlen had stashed all of his files on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, and 3 months after VE Day in Europe, Gehlen jumped, basically Gehlen was flown into the United States in the uniform of a four-star general. And as I said, then Gehlen, along with his entire organization, which was complete and intact at the end of World War II, were grafted onto the fledgling CIA formed in 1947, although they worked for U.S. intelligence between 45 and 47, and they became, for all intents and purposes, the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. Now, this is Hitler's Eastern Front Intelligence Organization, complete and intact from World War II. The Gehlen organization then became, for all intents and purposes, the NATO intelligence organization, supplied NATO with the vast bulk of its intelligence during the immediate post-war period and for quite some time thereafter. And when West Germany became a nation, when the Federal Republic of Germany was incorporated in 1956, Gehlen jumped once again from the CIA to West Germany, and the Gehlen organization became the West German Intelligence Service, West Germany's CIA, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, or the BND. It's a very, very, very important thing to keep in mind that all of America's intelligence for more than a decade after the end of World War II came exclusively through Hitler's Eastern Front Intelligence Organization, and even for a long time after that, the CIA and other intelligence organizations in this country continued to depend very heavily upon the Gehlen organization for its intelligence. Now, during the first two Radio Free America broadcasts, looking back from 1984, the hidden history of the Cold War, we covered two important aspects of the Gehlen organization in the early post-war history. First of all, as the Nazis retreated on the Eastern Front during World War II, they set up guerrilla groups to basically harass the Red Army in its rear. Now, these guerrilla groups were set up almost exclusively by Reinhard Gehlen, and he worked very closely with a man named Otto Skorzeny, setting up the werewolf guerrilla group that we talked about. And these guerrilla groups carried on a fierce guerrilla warfare in Eastern Europe until as late as 1952, primarily in Poland, the Ukraine, and the Baltic states. Now, Gehlen not only set up these guerrilla groups, but he continued to supply weapons and liaison officers to these groups basically while in the employ of the CIA, so that what you had was a continuum of warfare running from the Third Reich to the CIA, with Gehlen having set up these groups and continuing in contact with them and to ship them weapons and liaison officers while in the CIA, so that basically all they did was to change uniforms. Now, one of the organizations that was set up initially using some of these guerrillas set up by Reinhard Gehlen during the Third Reich and whose sponsorship was assumed by the CIA, one of the organizations which used some of these guerrillas and which was set up initially to work alongside of these guerrillas was the Green Beret, now known as the Special Forces. And Gehlen was in charge by a CIA official named Frank Wisner with setting up the Green Beret, and the three people he put in charge of this organization were three SS Nazi war criminals, basically a fellow named Professor Michael Achmeteli, A-C-H-M-E-T-E-L-I, a man named Franz Alfred Sieks, last name S-I-X, and a man named Emil Augsburg, last named A-U-G-S-B-U-R-G. All three worked on Hitler's final solution, that is to say, administering the Nazi extermination of European Jewry, and they then went to work for Gehlen in forming the Green Berets. And if you have any questions about that, to ask us about that during the question and answer period that we're going to have at the end of this broadcast, or you can contact us after the show, and we do have a means of getting Radio Free America tapes to people, not using the mails, but if you want to give us a call, we can tell you where you'd like to go, and that is the Galen Organization, in brief.
All right, now the first segment that we're going to read to you is from a book by Carl Oglesby entitled The Yankee and Cowboy War. Now this book, the copy that we have appeared in paperback from Berkeley Medallion Books, copyright 1976. Mr. Oglesby is a researcher who is formerly involved with all different kinds of things, including, among other things, student politics, and made some local appearances, and a fairly well-known individual, and now does quite a bit of research. Once again, the book, The Yankee and Cowboy War. What Oglesby is concentrating on here, and what I think is, in a way, the sort of the subtext of the broadcast tonight, is the continuity of policy, because most of us are raised to look at things historically as World War II being a period of intense dislocation, and then everything almost starting from scratch in 1945, and of course we hear all about, you know, the Yalta conferences and things of that nature, to lead us to believe that the world was completely remade. Well, what Oglesby is focusing on, and the reason I'm going into this such depth, I hope what you folks out there listening will focus on, is that in fact a lot of the structures never disappeared. They went complete from post-World War One right through World War II, and merely just changed costumes or changed masks and went right on. And that is, in fact, what we're talking about here. Once again, Carl Oglesby's The Yankee and Cowboy War, and speaking specifically of the Galen Organization, Mr. Oglesby writes as follows. Look what power the victors conceded the vanquished. Exclusive purveyor of intelligence on the Soviet Union and East Europe to the United States, West Germany, and NATO, Galen and the spirit kept alive in him and his staff had more power over official American perceptions in the post-war world than even a German victory could have given them. The Galen-Vlasov intelligence system had become a main source and fountain of official American consciousness. Behold the span of this concatenation. First, in the time of Trotsky, there is General Vlasov and his anti-Bolshevist army inspiring. The Vlasov apparatus is then, at a certain later point, assimilated to the Galen apparatus. Then, just as the White Russian spies jumped to the Nazis when their own army went down, so now the German Nazi and Russian Tsarist spies together jumped to the American army as the Wehrmacht was falling. Vlasov first became a department of Galen, then Galen became a department of Alan Dulles. This is how it came to pass that a Tsarist spy ring inside a Nazi spy ring took up the inner seats in the American foreign intelligence apparatus at the precise moment that this apparatus was starting to come forward as a major player in the great policy wars of Washington and the world. This is how it came to pass that everything official Washington would know about the Soviet Union and East Europe on most believable report, everything about the enemy our policymakers would most confidently believe, would come by way of Tsarists and Nazis installed at the center of our national intelligence system. That was a buzzer that would come home to roost again and again.
Now, one of the things in that passage by Oglesby that is very important to remember about the Galen Organization was that Galen both, in all of his various incarnations, when he was working for the Third Reich, when he was working for the CIA, and up continuous through his work for West Germany with the BND, made liberal use, very heavy use, of revanchist Eastern Europeans, that is to say white Russians, anti-Bolshevik Russians, and Eastern European reactionaries of various stripes who sought to overthrow or overturn the communist and socialist governments that were set up by the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe after the end of World War II. The Tsarists and Eastern European faction of the Galen Organization is very, very important, notably an organization called the Solidarists, who we'll tell you more about in our upcoming program about the Guns of November. They figured prominently in the assassination of President Kennedy. One of Oglesby's phrases there, behold the span of this concatenation, might well be applied to the Galen Organization as he did, and I'm going to read you now a biography of an SD man who went to work for the Galen Organization, and this will give you an idea of the span of Galen's operation, both in terms of breadth and time and the massive influence that that organization has had upon the history of the Cold War. Now, the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, was the SS intelligence service, the intelligence service of Hitler's infamous and bloodthirsty elite guard, the SS. Okay, now, this article comes from a magazine called Gung Ho. That's a mercenary trade publication, similar in scope and function to Soldier of Fortune. And this is from Gung Ho's issue of May of 1982. The article is called The CIA's Man for All Nations. It was authored by a man named William Seymour, S-E-Y-M-O-U-R, and the SD man in question here is a man named Helmut Stryker, last name S-T-R-E-I-C-H-E-R. And at the end of this article, Seymour gives a biography of Stryker. First of all, cover names, Rolf Meyer, Hans Moloff, Karl Rolf, Wilhelm William Rhein, Kark Schmidt, and others. Born Danzig, 1918, now the city in Poland known as Gdansk. Graduated from the University of Bonn, 1937. Military schools, 1937. Blutordensburg, Citadel of the Order of Blood, which was the educational headquarters of the Nazi regime at Vogelsang Castle. Sonthofen, for intermediate studies and basic training. SS Junkerschule, an SS officer candidate school south of Munich in the Bavarian Alps. Active duty, 1938, in Spain as an advisor and observer. Set up spy networks and contact drops used later in the war. Was wounded slightly in combat. 1939-40. In the United States with cover as a German journalist. Learned English and American customs as well. Also learned spy system and worked as a courier. 1940-41. In Germany for additional intelligence schooling and internal work. On duty in Eastern Europe as well. 1942. On the Russian front as a combat line officer. 1943-1945. In Europe, Africa, in and out of many nations, both neutral and involved in the war. Some contacts with Allied agents. Worked with Schellenberg, Skorzeny, Canaris, and others. Schellenberg was head of, head of the Sicherheitsdienst, SS intelligence. Wilhelm Canaris was the head of the Abwehr, regular German military intelligence. Otto Skorzeny was an SS man we're going to tell you all about in a little while. 1945. Surrendered to British near Kitzingen on the 7th of May, 1945, escaping the Russians. Cleared by Allied intelligence. He was formally accepted into work for U.S. Army intelligence in October of 1945. 1946-47. In Europe working for Central Intelligence Group, the forerunner to the CIA. 1948-50. In Europe, Africa, and Middle East for CIA. Had assignments in Greece and Israel. Keep in mind here that the Galen Organization is part of the CIA at this point. 1951-57. Assigned as co-op agent to General Reinhard Galen, chief of West Germany's Federal Intelligence Service, Bundesnachrichtendienst. Various assignments in Europe, including behind the Iron Curtain. 1958. In United States, working to assigned to training with U.S. Army to serve as an intelligence officer. Working with CIA solely at the time. 1958-61. In U.S. as intelligence officer with U.S. Army. Various duties including Cuban invasion. That is the Bay of Pigs, of course. Still with CIA at this time. 1961-65. In Africa and Middle East on CIA field assignments. 1966-67. In Europe realigning CIA and Allied co-op intelligence networks. 1968-70. In Africa and Middle East, senior field agent with intelligence gathering and observation for CIA. Posed as mercenary, writer, and tourist. 1971-73. Working in headquarter area, Langley, with training and plans assignments. 1974-77. In Africa and Middle East, intelligence gathering and inspection tours as supervisor. 1978. Retired, unquote. As of the 1st of July, 1978, 1979-1980, contract agent on special assignment for CIA, 1980, voluntary total retirement as of 15th of June, 1980. And One of the things that this biography here of Helmut Stryker points out, and one of the most important things to keep in mind about the Galen organization, is that it not only functioned as our intelligence wing, and a Nazi intelligence wing at that, after the end of the Second World War, but perhaps most importantly, it paved the way for thousands of SS and Gestapo men to move up in our own intelligence system, where many of them remain as senior officers to this day. And we're going to tell you about one of those senior officers later in the broadcast.
Now, I think, actually, the Stryker list, the Stryker resume, if you'll have it that way, almost is best serves as a metaphor for the entire experience of the American intelligence community and the Nazi intelligence community. You have somebody who starts out basically going through the SS rituals in the Ordensburg and places like that, and the blood rituals and all this stuff, and eventually winding up at Langley, Virginia, training American intelligence agents. I mean, it is a very fine metaphor for exactly where, as Oglesby might have put it, where we might have gone wrong, where we might have gone a bit off the track.
These buzzards came home to roost over and over again, as he points out. Now, you'll find, particularly looking through that resume, as Nip put it, of Helmut Stryker, all of the different bases he touches in terms of intelligence, all of the different U.S. intelligence operations that he was involved in. He was involved with the Bay of Pigs, he was involved with the operations in the Congo, training the U.S. Army, and really touched just about all of the major, with the exception of Southeast Asia, which I didn't see in there, although he was training the Army. They were just about all of the major theaters of operations that the U.S. has been involved with since the end of World War II.
It's very interesting, too, because if you match that that resume, that menu there up against a timeline, and you see where the places where he happens to be at the right time, I believe, as a matter of fact, what he had a date there for Greece, right, that was rather interesting. He showed up...
Let's see, 1948 to 50, at which point the United States was basically very much involved in the Greek Civil War, which had its origins and during the Second World War, when, and you'll recall, those of you who heard the first Radio Free America broadcast, or those of you who'd like to obtain that broadcast, that the Greek partisans had kicked the Nazis out during World War II. The British then undertook open combat against the Greek partisans in 1944, several months before the Battle of the Bulge. That then spread out of World War II, just like the guerrilla warfare in Eastern Europe, and then the CIA took sponsorship of the fascists and the reactionary forces in Greece, and that's where old Helmut Stryker was to that date.
Indeed. So four years after the Nazis have been driven out of Greece by the partisans, the CIA is bringing them right back in again in positions of power.
Now, one of the major Cold War elements that an institution which has been very much involved in the Cold War in terms of propaganda is something called Radio Free Europe. And of course, we've named this broadcast as a sort of a takeoff on that. We call this Radio Free America. Now, Radio Free Europe, of course, was involved in broadcasting propaganda to the Soviet Union and Eastern Bloc countries. And Reinhard Galen figured very prominently in the formation of Radio Free Europe.
You may also remember, that those of you who do follow the news, that Radio Free Europe has shown up several times lately in the news during the past couple of years because of a resurgence of, it's hard to say politicization because it's obviously a political thing, but apparently the political control of Radio Free Europe has gotten rather heavy-handed under the Reagan administration. We're going to touch on some more recent aspects, too, but first we're going to give you some of the early history and some of the Galen connections. This first section is from a book called Galen, Spy of the Century by E.H. Cookridge, and this is copyright 1971, published by Random House. The Soviet blockade of Berlin was accompanied by violent and effective propaganda by radio leaflets and newspapers, which was aimed at frightening West Berliners and West Germans and weakening their trust in the Allies. Hitherto, the latter had made hardly any answer to this concerted propaganda assault. Wisner, who is Frank Wisner, who we've discussed in previous broadcasts, high-ranking American intelligence official, who had early contacts with the Nazis and bringing them into the intelligence system. Wisner, advised by Galen and several of his radio experts, immediately went to work to remedy this situation. A powerful radio transmitter was to be established to counteract communist aggression over the ether. Even when the initial plans were still being drafted, Wisner was envisaging a chain of transmitters broadcasting in all the languages of the many nations within the Soviet orbit, which would fan discontent and encourage opposition and open rebellion against the communist rulers. Initially, there was only one American medium which could be used. This was RIAS, Radio in the American Sector. the official transmitter of the U.S. military commander in Berlin. It limited its transmission to brief bulletins, news talks, and a great deal of musical entertainment. Wisner had little difficulty in impressing upon Major General Frank L. Howley, the sector commandant, that RIAS programs must be radically revised. Galen provided a few experienced broadcasters, which soon brought more zip into the transmissions. But the plan of the great transmitter took some time. Wisner was unable to obtain from his superiors. He turned to American business tycoons for help. Alan Dulles, whom President Truman had asked to head a committee of three to investigate the effectiveness of Hillenkoetter's CIA, willingly offered his help. The two company lawyers passed the begging bowl along with splendid success. At that time, several private bodies in the United States, such as the Council on Foreign Relations, the Council Against Communist Aggression, Congress for Cultural Freedom, American Friends of Russian Freedom, the Free Asia Committee, and a number of, quote, citizens' committees in several states and cities, some of which were to lend support to Senator Joseph McCarthy, were engaged in fighting communism in their own fashion. Dulles and Wisner enlisted the prestigious help of General Eisenhower, who had retired from his post as U.S. Chief of Staff to become the President of Columbia University, and assembled the Free Europe Committee, whose list of sponsors read like a who's who of American industry and banking. Headed by Alan Valentine, erstwhile Yale history professor and Rhodes Scholar at Oxford who had gone into big business and was a director of the Finance Securities Trust Company, the American Sulphur Corporation, and the Buffalo-Rochester-Pittsburgh Railroad, they included Clark McAdams Clifford, a director of the National Bank of Washington, C. Rodney Smith, president of American Airlines, Frank Altschul, senior partner in the banking house of Lazard Frères, C.D. Jackson of the Luce Organization, publishers of Time, Life, and Fortune magazines, A.F. Francis, chairman of the General Food Corporation, the world's largest breakfast cereal manufacturers, Henry Ford II, Edwin H. Land, president of Polaroid, and William O. Baker, vice president of the Bell Telephones Corporation. There were many more willing donors, amongst them General Motors, General Electric, Westinghouse, Chrysler, United Food, and all the oil companies, headed by Esso and Standard Oil.
So those are some of the people that Wisner turned to get the funds that he was unable to get from his immediate superiors in the early days of the CIA. Continuing now with the history of Radio Free Europe. Early in 1950, Radio Free Europe was installed in a row of prefabricated buildings in the Englischer Garten, a pleasant park in the center of Munich. Within an amazingly brief period, with an initial budget of $10 million, Radio Free Europe began its transmissions from its new powerful station. It also used existing transmitters in several friendly countries. In the course of time, Radio Free Europe grew into a chain of 29 radio stations, beaming round-the-clock anti-communist propaganda in 16 languages to East Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, and the former Baltic states. Broadcasts in Albanian were eventually discontinued when it was discovered that there were very few radio receivers in Albania. A chain of transmitters was also set up in Saudi Arabia, Iran, Pakistan, Thailand, Vietnam, Indonesia, and Japan, which cover the Middle East, Africa, Asiatic Russia, Southeast Asia, and the Far East. From Frankfurt, the War of the Ether was initiated by a kindred foundation, Radio Liberty, which broadcast exclusively to the Soviet Union in a multitude of its languages and dialects, from Russian, Ukrainian, Ruthenian, Finnish, and Latvian, to Turkoman, Tajik, Chuvak, and the Ural-Altaic dialects of Mongolia. The official Voice of America completed the mighty barrage, catering for listeners with sufficient knowledge of English. Galen eagerly cooperated from the very outset with Radio Free Europe and its supervisors from the Office of Policy Coordination, Colonel Kotek and William Griffith. He delegated as his liaison officer ex-SA Bonfuhrer Peter Fischer, who went under the alias of Major Fiedler. He had become the chief radio expert at Pulak and could boast excellent credentials. During the war, he had served in the SD in the Netherlands under SS Sturmbannführer Josef Schreider, who had been instrumental in conducting Funkspiel radio deceptions with London. succeeding in catching by the use of fake signals nearly every SOE agent sent to the Dutch resistance from England, and also the leaders of the Resistance Council. SOE, by the way, is the British Special Operations Executive, which conducted covert operations in mainland Europe during the war, and a fellow by the name of William Stevenson, who we're going to refer to later in the broadcast, was a member of that organization, and he wrote about Galen as well. So Galen was instrumental in setting up Radio Free Europe, which basically broadcast to the communist countries and was ostensibly presenting them with the view of freedom. And it's worth noting the heavy Galen links with this organization, because there are indications that basically these Radio Free Europe Galen links have been maintained, at least to a certain extent, right up into the last few years. Now, in the second of our Radio Free America broadcasts, we talked about a Romanian Iron Gardist, a Romanian fascist, part of the Romanian Native Fascist Movement sponsored by and allied to Nazi Germany. He was a fellow by the name of, initially, Viorel, and later Valerian Trifa. Now, he worked for Galen near the end of World War II. Eventually, he became the Archbishop of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate and was close to, among others, J. Edgar Hoover and Richard Milhouse Nixon. Specifically, was called upon by Nixon to give the opening prayer before the United States Senate in 1955. Now, he worked for Galen, as we saw in a book called Wanda, the Search for Nazis in America. At the end of World War II, there are indications that he went to work for Galen, that he stayed working with the Galen organization when Galen jumped to the United States. And, Viorel Trifa cropped up, or Valerian Trifa cropped up in the news within several times in the last few years. And, as I said, there are indications that the Galen organization maintains its contacts with Radio Free Europe.
All right, this next selection is an article from the San Francisco Chronicle for Wednesday, February 20th, 1980. This is a Jack Anderson column, and it's entitled RFE, or Radio Free Europe, in Hot Water. And it reads as follows: Radio Free Europe, which gets $85 million from American taxpayers each year for beaming propaganda to the communist world, has touched off a congressional investigation by broadcasting a lengthy interview with an alleged Nazi war criminal and then firing two employees who blew the whistle on the outrageous program. The RFE official directly responsible for the broadcast has not been reprimanded, possibly because he has a close friend and former RFE colleague on the staff of the president's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski. Chairman John Granowski of the Board for International Broadcasting, which supervises RFE, has appointed a special counsel to look into the matter. The interview, last May 1st, gave a sympathetic airing to the views of Valerian Trifa. Justice Department documents charge that Trifa, as a leader of the Nazi-oriented Iron Guard in his native Romania, was personally responsible for the deaths of 4,000 Jews in a 1941 pogrom. He eventually came to this country, settled in Detroit, and became a bishop of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate. I should just put in parenthetically here, according to Bloom, whose book Dave mentioned, he got the name Valerian, which is his bishop's name, and got his bishopship, or his bishopric, when he and a bunch of his Iron Guard thugs literally surrounded the house of the present bishop in upstate Michigan, dragged the priests out, beat them with clubs, and literally took over the leadership of the Romanian Orthodox Church, according to Bloom's book, Wanted the Search for Nazis in America. Anyway, going back to Anderson's article, he eventually came to this country, settled in Detroit, and became a bishop of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate. The Justice Department is trying to deport him on grounds that he lied about his past when he became a U.S. citizen. Congressional investigators, for Representative Elizabeth Holtzman, Democrat of New York, have received evidence that, quote, the broadcast was not simply an inadvertent judgmental error, but represented a conscious management decision made over staff objections. It was, said the investigators, quote, part of a pattern of such questionable decisions with respect to both substance and personnel made over the past several years, unquote. The investigators also found that Radio Free Europe employees, quote, have been harassed and threatened for attempting publicly to expose what they consider to be the facts of this case, unquote. Indeed, two employees in the Romanian broadcast division, Edgar Raphael and Jacob Popper, have been fired, apparently because they told Holtzman about the Trifa situation. Radio Free Europe President Glenn Ferguson ignored a specific directive from Granowski not to fire the two men. Noel Bernard, director of the Romanian service, is still riding high at Radio Free Europe. Sources say he is an old pal of Paul Henze, H-E-N-Z-E, a veteran CIA operative who is now a member of Brzezinski's White House staff. The two served together at Radio Free Europe's Munich station in the 1950s.
So, well, a number of things to take note there. First of all, note the links between Radio Free Europe and the Nazi contingent brought into this country at the end of World War II. Valerian Trifa still being called upon to broadcast Nazi broadcast propaganda to Romania in 1979, and two employees who complain about this get fired, which would indicate that at least to a certain extent, the pro-Nazi sympathies within that organization were current as of 1980. Okay, and note the link between Henze, Paul Henze, and Zbigniew Brzezinski, the Polish-born former national security advisor for President Carter. It's worth noting that Henze, of documented CIA background, is the author of a current book about the shooting of Pope John Paul II, which maintains that Pope John Paul II was, in fact, killed by Bulgarian secret service Bulgarian agents, and he implicates the KGB and so forth. Take note of Henze's CIA background.
Henze's Radio Free America propaganda background. Put an even finer
Radio
point
Free
on
Europe.
It. Radio Free Europe propaganda background. Yes, indeed.
And also, well, the fact that Henze and Noel Bernard, the fellow who hired Trifa to broadcast for the Romanian desk of Radio Free Europe, worked together at Radio Free Europe in Munich. Now, that's at the aforementioned Englischer Garten, and Galen's headquarters was very nearby at Pulak, near the Dachau concentration camp. Now, we're going to talk some more about connections between very prominent personages and the Galen organization later on in the broadcast. Now, as we indicated earlier in the program, one of the most important aspects of the Galen organization for American purposes here is not only the fact that all of our information about the Soviet Union for a long time came through the Galen organization, but the fact that that organization, the Galen organization, prepared the way and paved the way for literally thousands of Nazi war criminals, SS and Gestapo men, to move up into the U.S. intelligence system.
Now, many of you out there who are familiar with movies and TV and things like that may be aware of a book and was later made into a movie by a man named Frederick Forsyth, the man who wrote The Day of the Jackal. The book and movie in question is called The Odessa File. And The Odessa File, the movie and book, told the story of a secret organization of ex-Nazis, you know, all banded together to commit acts of terrorism and to protect each other, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very lively, you know, exciting sort of a suspense book. Well, what a lot of people don't realize is that Frederick Forsyth, who himself was a journalist and had worked extensively in Europe, among other places, was talking about a very real, very actual organization that, to the best of our knowledge, certainly still exists today and has had an awful lot of effect, not only on European politics, but in fact on world politics, including those of the United States. A real organization, not something made up for the sake of a spy thriller, but a very real organization that has brought some very real, very frightening people into intimate positions of power in the Western intelligence system.
Now, the name Odessa is actually derived, I don't know what the German is, but from basically the name, the Order of Ex-SS Men. That is exactly what it is. It is a post-war fraternal organization. It's much more than just fraternal, but it is an organization of basically the post-war alumni of Hitler's SS, and they basically, one of the purposes of the Odessa is to see to it that the organization continues to function in allegiance to Adolf Hitler. All SS men had to swear, in addition to their rigorous Nazi training, had to swear an oath of lifetime allegiance to Adolf Hitler. And the Odessa organization, its primary goal is to see to it, in ways peaceful and violent, that the SS men live in accordance with their oath, that their allegiance to Adolf Hitler continues to up until their death. And the organization, the Odessa organization, is headed up by a fellow who you heard reference to earlier, a former SS colonel named Otto Skorzeny, last name S-K-O-R-Z-E-N-Y. Now, Skorzeny is not only the head of the Odessa, but basically organized the organization along the lines of a corporation. Now, much of the Odessa's early income came from the sale of arms. Now, at the end of World War II, of course, there were a great many armaments still sitting around, and the there were still many conflicts throughout the world, and one of the things the Odessa did, one of the ways they provided funding for themselves early in the war, shortly after the war, I should say, was to traffic in arms, to get arms from where they were to where they were needed. For example, one of Odessa's first significant arms sales was a sale of a contingent of 15 Messerschmitt 109s to Israel for to form one of the first fighter wings in the Israeli Air Force. And basically, through the sales of arms, getting the arms from where they were to where they were needed, the Odessa was able to finance many of its early operations and was organized, as I said, along the lines of a corporation. Now, Otto Skorzeny, during the Cold War years, put the Odessa to work for the Central Intelligence Agency and the Galen Organization. There was a kind of a reciprocal relationship between the two. The Odessa functioned as part of the CIA under Skorzeny's direction, as we're going to read you here in a second. And in addition to that, CIA served as a means of consolidating the Odessa, both bodily and in spirit as well. So there is a kind of a reciprocal relationship. Odessa becomes part of CIA, and that work for CIA, Skorzeny's recruiting work of SS men for CIA, as we're going to see in a minute, became one of the means for consolidating and coalescing the Odessa, kind of the way you put vinegar. Those of you who have ever poached an egg, you have to put a little bit of vinegar in the water to keep the egg from just spreading out all over. And that's how the CIA, in effect, worked for the Odessa. It became the device for causing it to coalesce. And it's worth noting also that many aspects of the U.S. intelligence apparatus were not aware of this incorporation of Odessa as part of the Galen Organization, and there were kind of crossed signals throughout many uses of these heinous Nazi war criminals as part of the U.S. intelligence system. There are many reports given by people who weren't on the inside that, hey, you know, these monsters are moving up into the U.S. intelligence system, and they were unaware that, in fact, they were being sponsored from on high. Okay, to Skorzeny's incorporation of the Odessa into the Central Intelligence Agency. I'm going to read you now from a book called Skorzeny, subtitled Hitler's Commando. That was authored by a man named Glenn Infield, and it was copyrighted 1981, published in hardcover by St. Martin's Press. And Infield writes in Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando, "The Western powers were not too concerned with the Skorzeny movement at this time because it was small enough for their occupation troops to handle easily. Later, when the Skorzeny movement became known as the Bruderschaft, the Brotherhood, and the membership continued to grow, the West, instead of being apprehensive, encouraged its growth. The international crisis caused by the Soviets' covert and direct aggression had created a vital need for help, and Skorzeny, by this time a member of the silent conspiracy with the U.S. intelligence, promised his cooperation. From his cells at Dachau and Darmstadt, and from hiding after his escape, Skorzeny very efficiently guided the organization until by the early 1950s, it was a group to be reckoned with by those opposed to fascism and Third Reich principles."
Okay. Now, speaking about how Skorzeny was, as Dave mentioned earlier, brought into the coalescing heart of the Odessa through the ages of Western intelligence, again, from Skorzeny, the North Koreans had moved into South Korea on June 26, 1950, and many Allied officials thought it was a prelude to a Soviet attack on Western Europe. The United States, France, and Great Britain had only 7 undermanned divisions with which to hold West Germany from falling under the influence of the Soviets, while the Russians had 22 divisions ready, plus the new East German army. For the Western nations facing the communists in Asia and in Europe, German industrial might and Prussian military prowess both became invaluable. However, there were several embarrassing problems. Many of the German industrialists were in prison or still awaiting trial in an internment camp. Most of the prominent SS officers and men were on the run or in prison too. How could the munitions plants be rebuilt and manned by the former owners without the United States being ridiculed by the rest of the world? The Germans had been threatened with death or long years in prison for exactly the same thing that the United States now wanted them to do, except this time there would be no slave labor. And the German military manpower? That was the reason for Skorzeny's trip to Germany. As one communist reported, Quote, Skorzeny went to Germany in 1950 to hire as many of his experienced SS men as possible to help the Americans. He first went to the Munich area, to the village of Sutten, where he moved in with a family by the name of Scholm. It was a perfect hideout for Skorzeny, who stayed there for 9 months, using the alias of Rolf Steinbauer, while contacting his SS acquaintances in Bavaria. Once again, it was a photographer who forced Skorzeny's hand. The Munich newspaper, Die Abendzeitung, getting a tip that Skorzeny was living in Sutten, sent a photographer to the village, and he secretly snapped a picture of Skorzeny. The newspaper printed it the next day with the caption, Are Skorzeny and Steinbauer one and the same person? Strangely enough, no police went to investigate. But journalists did, and Skorzeny promptly left Sutton to take up residence in Munich at number 31 Blumenstrasse. Rudolf J. Geiser, special agent of the U.S. Counterintelligence Corps, made a reconnaissance of the building and reported. Skorzeny, he reports, using the alias of Rolf Steinbauer, is living at number 31 Blumenstrasse, Munich, together with a former girlfriend of his by the name of Louisa Price. The building in question is a 3.5-story brick construction located at the corner of Blumenstrasse and Angertorstrasse. The ground floor of said building contains the storage rooms for a printing concern located next door. The first and second floors are occupied by the Reparations Office, Munich branch. The third floor contains the offices of a construction firm, Macher and Price, and also the living quarters of Price. A check of all doorbells and nameplates on the various doors failed to reveal the name Steinbauer. Judging from the appearance of the building, it can be considered as an ideal hideout, especially since the building is in a fairly inconspicuous locality. Skorzeny was there, all right. So was Hermann Lauterbacher, Lauterbacher. Hermann Lauterbacher, former deputy Reich leader of the Hitler Youth, who was working with the Galen organization and the Americans. After arranging with Lauterbacher to recruit SS officers in the Munich area, Skorzeny moved on. He spent some time in West Berlin, a feat in itself, since security measures were extremely strict in the divided city at that time. While in Berlin, he stayed with Hilde Weissner, an actress whom he knew very well during the war. Later, after he had completed his business with SS contacts in West Berlin, he and the actress went to Hamburg, and once again, Skorzeny recruited a large number of his former SS comrades. British intelligence spotted Skorzeny in Hamburg and, not knowing of his mission for the Galen organization, prepared to arrest him and return him to Darmstadt. It took several discreet hints from the CIA to, quote, lay off before the tenacious English agents looked the other way.
Now, again, take note of the fact that there's a kind of a reciprocal relationship between the Odessa and the CIA, that Skorzeny, in the CIA's demand for anti-Soviet agents, took his fledgling Odessa organization and put it to work for the CIA, and in turn, that work became one of the major tools for Skorzeny to build the Odessa organization. Now, this is a pattern that we're going to see some more in our examination of the Galen organization. Although the Nazis did indeed go to work for the CIA as anti-Soviet agents, at the same time, the Nazis used this CIA sponsorship for the furtherance of their own aims, and those didn't always totally coincide with what Western democracy had in mind. And the semi-autonomy of the Galen organization and of this SS contingent in particular is something to keep in mind, because while they did work against the Soviets, they used CIA sponsorship to further their own aims as well. Also, keep in mind the name of Hermann Lauterbacher. That was the name of one of the SS men that Skorzeny was recruiting during his rounding up of SS men to put to work for Odessa and CIA, because we're going to come back to Lauterbacher later.
Again, just to wrap up this last section, a point I want to home in on, because it's very important, especially when we're working with this kind of material, because when you're talking about things that are of this magnitude and yet of this that most people are this relatively ignorant about, people accuse you of being, you know, a conspiracy theorist and trying to put together wild scenarios where the entire world is controlled, et cetera, or an entire government top to bottom is in fact corrupt and in on secrets. Well, The answer, of course, is not as simple as people like that would pretend that it was. And obviously, this is a case where individuals could control, to some extent, an entire government top to bottom was not necessarily corrupt. But as we saw in the previous Radio Free America, talking about Bielorussians, much of the people who are agreeing to fund the kind of activity that the CIA was involved in through their Nazi and Eastern European fascist proxies was being presented through the filter of one or two trusted old boy network intelligence officers like Wisner, like later Alan Dulles. As a matter of fact, we saw Frank Wisner constructing a large tissue of fabrications as to who these people were that he had hired, how they were a bunch of anti-communists on the run from persecution when in fact they were Bielorussian Nazi supporters. So it's a very difficult kind of a dance, as Dave is talking about, going on, where both sides, and specifically individuals on both sides, were using each other, and of course the people who were paying the bill, were you and I, or in this case probably our parents, for some of us, the American taxpayer, as always, keeping the Nazis and the CIA happy as they waltz together across the crumbling ruins of Eastern Europe.
We're making the interest payments today.
Indeed, we certainly are.